Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Roslevy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. On Connect the Dots, we make the connection every week between personal health and your total health environment, the health of our air, water, food, and earth, the health of our society and our communities, the health of the entire global ecology. So every week on Connect the Dots, we look at different aspects of those interconnections through conversations with leading experts that are raising awareness, teaching science, promoting activism to protect our health. And health are all our health, both personal health and the health of everyone, all living beings on Earth. So that's what we do every week on the show, and we've had a whole series of wonderful conversations with different people with prime and urgent issues, and today is no exception. I just want to note that today, of course, is the day of the presidential debate, and as many regular listeners know, I've had ongoing coverage of fracking and its effects on health and the public policy steps and citizen actions that people need to take in order to protect health in a larger environmental context where we have industries and processes and foods and a whole range of things that cause health problems. So that's what we talk about every week. And of course, just in the way that we pay attention to politics on the national level, all of that also affects our health. So on this program, we look at everything through the health lens. And not just looking inward, but also looking outward. So as regular listeners know, I begin every week with an action. And this week, we have a fun action. Basically, we have a party to invite you to if you're anywhere in the New York or Tri-State region and national audiences. You can take action on GMOs and other things this week and listen to the presidential debates. But if you're in the New York Tri-State area, I want to let you know about a terrific party called Party to Save the Village. And the village is Greenwich Village, New York's Greenwich Village. The party is taking place in Greenwich Village, and the urgency is to save Greenwich Village from pipelines, radon, fracking, and other total insanity. This is straight from the mouths of Sane Energy, which is sponsoring the party, along with Occupy the Pipeline, because all of the gas drilling and fracking that we've been talking about, that may happen in one area or actually in over 34 states of the United States, but the gas itself has to be transported to other areas where it will be used and delivered, and this entails building massive pipeline infrastructures, and the pipeline production companies don't do it that safely. There's a history of explosions and even death and a lot more. We've had past shows that cover the concerns about both the pipelines and carrying radioactive gas down into urban environments. So I'll refer you to our archives to get more background information. But meanwhile, if you're in the city or in the tri-state area, here's your chance to party. It's happening tonight, Wednesday, and you can go to the LGBT Center at 208 West 13th Street between 7th Avenue and Greenwich Avenue and take part. It's going to be a terrific evening with a lot of great people. I was invited by about six different people, and it should be a lot of fun. Reverend Billy will be there. There are going to be artists. There's just going to be a whole lot of music and great things going on. You can find out more by going to saneenergyproject.org. And you are welcome. You don't have to be part of the LGBT community, but it's certainly you're welcome, whatever your persuasion. Go have a great time. It's a very modest donation that supports a really great cause. So we're sort of celebrating both because it's really important to celebrate the wins and to prepare for the next round. And there's other celebrating going on in New York State. I've devoted a couple of shows recently to the downside economic impacts of fracking wherever it goes. And right now, there's been a question about whether it will come to New York. You can read more about this on Alternet by Googling me and Allison Rose Levy, and I have several blogs detailing the situation in New York State, so I won't go into that in greater detail. But there's been some recent developments just in the last week where Governor Cuomo, the governor of New York, has said before was kind of moving into first gear to allow fracking across the Delaware River and into New York State, but then hit the pause button, which I had written about and hoped that he would do and suggested the reasons why that might be a good idea in the Alternet blog that I did a couple of weeks back. But he's actually done that, and the reason is he's finally heard public outcry and concern about the lack of a health assessment in planning this kind of move, and concerns about what all of the health impacts could potentially be, which really there's no way of knowing without a health impact assessment. So you've heard me say this on the show. Everybody that's been concerned about fracking coming to New York has also raised the health matter. And so this is also a cause to celebrate, but it's not a complete, you know, blast out victory. But there is some cause for celebration that the governor has heard the voices of concern and hit the pause button instead of moving forward immediately with fracking as he had predicted he would do. He's paused to conduct a health impact assessment. We'll be talking about that more completely with the expert on today's show, but I just wanted to give you a little background. Before welcoming to Connect the Dots, my guest today, her name is Dr. Larissa Derska. Hope I pronounced that correctly. She's an MD and a pediatrician who is director of pediatrics at Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, in our region. So she's had over 20 years of work directly with children as a pediatrician, and she's moved on from there to defending the rights and health of children in a whole bunch of different ways, and most recently over the last several years has been serving and focusing as an advocate for public health on the issue of gas drilling. She's a founding member of Sullivan Area Citizens for Responsible Energy Development, which is an affiliate member of Physicians, Scientists, and Engineers for Healthy Energy. She also serves on the steering committee of Damascus Citizens for Sustainability. So she's going to be with us today, and we're going to be talking all about the likely health impacts and health assessments and why we need to conduct them here in New York State. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Dr. Derska.
Thank you so much for that welcome, Allison.
So it's really great to have you on the show. Let me just ask a question or two just to begin. You know, before we get into the assessment issue, are there, from a scientific perspective, concerns about health? Recently, in response to Governor Cuomo's decision to hit the pause button and look into the health impacts, various entities and, you know, companies and landowners who hope to profit from this practice have been saying in venues like the Wall Street Journal, why is he looking into the science? We have the science. Do we have the science on the health impacts of fracking? How much of a picture about it do we have? Is there enough to cause concern?
The answer to your last question is yes, there is cause for concern. And there is quite a bit of science that is available and has accumulated, and even in peer-reviewed journals. However, none of that literature had been included in the Supplemental Generic Environmental Impact Statement. Or
so these are the guidelines that New York State developed that were going to guide the fracking if they were ever to go forward.
That's right. And that was developed, the last draft that we saw, that the public saw, was in 2011, and that's when hearings were held and 67,000 comments were received by the Department of Environmental Conservation, and a great number of those were health-related, people pointing out either health impacts that they've witnessed personally, perhaps even experienced, comments from physicians and scientists who have looked at this issue and felt that the impacts were inadequately addressed in the SGIS, and then pointing to the research that was currently available and that had not been included in the SGIS. The stressors are numerous.
Can you give us a bit of a picture on those? Just an overview of, you know, what the main ones are.
Mm-hmm. Of course. There are at least 10, 12, 15 issues that we are concerned about that have not been adequately addressed or that could not even protect all of the people who could potentially be impacted. And we can go back to the importance of that when we speak about Commissioner Martin's statement. But there are numerous abandoned wells in New York State that have either not been plugged or are being ignored or some other reason are not identified. And those are conduits for the toxins that are way down below. So if gas drilling were to come to an area where those abandoned wells are, well, those abandoned wells can just be a straw that allows all of these toxins to come up. So that's just one issue. There's air contamination that's related to chemicals, flaring, to silica exposure. Silica sand is what's used as the proppant in gas drilling and fracking operations, and that is currently transported from the northern Midwest area, and is what is pumped into the hole when fracking occurs. Well, that silica is extremely toxic, and it can cause issues for workers. They can develop silicosis, which is a disease that causes lungs to harden, which can eventually also predispose the worker to cancer, and also infections such as tuberculosis. The silica is not limited to just the area where the gas drilling is occurring. It's also, the neighbors, the neighboring homes, which can be 100, 200 feet from where this fracking operation is occurring, can be exposed to this silica. This is the technology that's currently used. There is no proposal for another kind of technology, and so mm-hmm. there's no way to protect those people right now from those. There are also accidents with the 1,000-plus truck trips that each fracked well requires. We know from the Centers for Disease Control and National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health that accidents are a leading cause of death in especially the young workers in the gas drilling industry. And so those mm-hmm. are things that are not really easily preventable. Yeah, more education perhaps, but not totally preventable. And of course that exposes the children who are crossing the roads, the families that are in their cars driving around. And this truck traffic occurs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Mm. There are chemicals that are currently used. You know, that nobody's gone to a green technology, so there are chemicals, many of them undisclosed. Doctors don't know what to look for. Many of them are endocrine-disrupting chemicals, and can cause air contamination. Some are related to diesel. There is a whole myriad of the chemicals question that we don't have answers to and that haven't been addressed. And the large one is that they're not disclosed. Mm-hmm. you know, doctors don't even know where to look.
Let me just interrupt for a second and just pick up on one point. So when you mentioned, and we've covered this on the show before, we've had Theo Colburn on who did the original research on this, but when chemicals disrupt the hormonal system, that's what endocrine system is, it's the hormones, then that will contribute to the risk of higher incidence of things like cancers, will it not?
Well, cancers...
We don't know at what levels, but when you're disrupting the hormonal system, that is an issue, isn't it?
Yes, that's just one of the possible issues. But, you know, mm-hmm. there's also the issue of reproductive of fertility, reproductive ability in the future, in future generations, chromosomal aberrations, genetic
mutations.
So those are, you know, those are very, very significant. And, of course, genetic mutations, numbers-wise, can lead to, you know, given enough of them, can lead to cancer. So, yeah, it's a myriad of problems from the endocrine-disrupting chemicals.
Wow.
And the thing about endocrine-disrupting chemicals is their action is at extremely low doses. You know, to say, oh, we're only using, you know, half of a percent of the chemicals, they wouldn't say they're endocrine disrupting chemicals, but they might say that there is a half a percent of the total volume of the mix is chemicals. Well, if let's say 30 or 40 or 50% of them are endocrine disrupting chemicals, that's an awful lot of them, but you only need a tiny, tiny amount to have an effect.
Right. And that's so we tend to think, you know, something gets diluted. I mean, the average person will tend to think, oh, something gets diluted. It's like vanilla extract. If I didn't put enough in the pancake mix, I won't taste it. So it must be a very tiny amount. But the chemicals that you're describing are actually industrial hazardous waste. So it's a very different thing in terms of, oh, well, I had a little bit of it and it didn't matter. In fact, and also there are many of them, and they react synergistically. I believe there's been scientific research that shows as well that, you know, the scientists had assumed that if there was like a 1 plus 1 plus 1 effect, if you had, let's say, three of the chemicals acting, and, of course, there's many more. There's hundreds is what we're talking about, but just to illustrate, you know, if there's 1 plus 1 plus 1, if there are three chemicals, then it kind of adds up to 3. But in fact, what they found is that these chemicals negatively synergize, and so, in fact, it has a geometric effect. And this is not merely of concern to those in the immediate areas of activity, is it not? It could have downstream effects.
Sure, all of these could have downwind and downstream effects. The pathways of exposure are there, but it's unfortunately it's not 1 plus 1 plus 1 because we don't know what 1 and 1 and 1 are. So it's more like x plus y plus z equals some other unknown, and those you know, x, y, z's are all unknowns, and so that's one of the problems. Is we need a lot more information on the chemicals, much more disclosure, what goes down and what comes back up.
So in this context, it sounds like there is enough science, to summarize, and tell me if I have this right or wrong, Larissa, but it seems like there's enough science to say we're taking some serious risks here, but it also seems like lacking the complete information and more science, we can't quantify all of the risk and how perilous it is for how many people. We're kind of somewhere, you know, we turn to science for answers, but unless you do the studies and the assessments, unless the science that you're looking for has been well researched and funded, it could be many years before we have the complete picture. So the question, but we're somewhere on the way there, enough to raise concern. So then that becomes the question of, you know, do you just ignore a growing scientific body of evidence? Or, you know, at what point do you have to say, this could be endangering too many people? You know, let's stop and allow science to proceed. And science is slow. We know that in terms
of how long it takes. Well, that's what's encouraging about what's happening in the very recent past. First, Governor Cuomo started the conversation about about science. Leading this discussion, and
at the very beginning, he said that he made that promise: science will lead.
Well, a few months ago, he was speaking about the science, and we were encouraged that he was going to pay attention to it because the science was pointing to the facts, as I've just given a very short overview of, but there are a lot more. And so the science is there, but some of the science is there. As you say, Allison, a lot more needs to be assessed in a quantitative fashion, but also qualitative. You know, there are some things that you need to do a qualitative analysis on, such as vulnerable populations, and to address issues such as social and environmental justice. Those are harder to quantify, but they definitely are features of the process that's occurring as we see it in Pennsylvania. And that's where some a public health process such as a health impact assessment would be very helpful.
Can you tell our listeners a bit more about what would constitute a complete trustworthy health impact assessment?
Sure. Just a little bit of background on where this health impact assessment comes from. Back in 1999, the World Health Organization presented a summary of needs for to address health in any land use decision. This became a process called the health impact assessment, and it can be used in informing the decision makers about the health impacts on a land use decision where they otherwise may not have been looking at health. Mm-hmm. So it's a combination of procedures, methods, and other public health tools that judges the potential or perhaps unintended effects, and sometimes land use planners or politicians may not be looking at the health impacts, but the health impact assessment will bring those to the foreground and allow the decision makers to weigh the health part in their decision. Mm-hmm. So it also looks at the health of a population, so it looks at a baseline health. And also, once the stressors are identified of the particular land use decision, the distribution of the effects of that decision on the population. So mm-hmm. you could look at the vulnerable groups such as children, the elderly, perhaps in this situation, the number of patients with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or asthma, and see what percentage of population is living on a truck route, or how far they're living from proposed wells. You know, so you would be looking at specific populations.
And you also perhaps those who were planning to start a family would also be among that group, I would suppose, as well, because that's a concern. If, as we know from rising rates of various illnesses, that are worsened, increased by toxic exposures just to ordinary everyday chemicals and products, the toxicity comes to the fetus through the mother, so that's also a concern, I would suspect.
Yes, and there's some preliminary research that is indicating perhaps some low birth weight risks to women who live near gas drilling operations during their pregnancy.
And then there would also be risks to populations that would be on water or air streams, and those need to be quantified. So, you've given us some history, but what is a health impact assessment? What does it look at? How optimally should it be designed the complete information?
Sure. Some of your listeners may be familiar with an environmental impact statement, which is the environmental look at the land use decision, and that's been in practice for many, many years. And so the health impact assessment works in a similar way, which is that it has a certain number of steps that are followed. It starts with a screening which identifies the project or the policy that this health impact assessment would advise. It starts to bring on board the stakeholders, And that's a very important part of the health impact assessment. It, the stakeholders are involved in every step of the process, and I'll go on to the subsequent ones in a moment. But stakeholders are the potential collaborators, they're community organizations or community advocates. They could be public health agencies, such as the Department of Public Health, a planning department, a regulatory agency, could be a university, a school district, or simply a health impact assessment consultant. So anybody who's interested in this land use decision can become a stakeholder. And these people are involved in, so let's say in the screening part, they can identify the criteria for selecting the priority issues for the stressors, and which health issues need to be studied through this. What's important to them is what they're going to bring to the table.
Mm-hmm.
So the next step after the screening is the scoping, which identifies which health effects to consider. And again, it's independent of, you know, the decision makers are at the table, but they're not the ones directing the study. So that's been another big part of what we're advocating for, is independence of this study. So in other words, the lead agency should be an independent entity, such as School of Public Health, an Institute of Public Health, or an organization that is independent and hasn't developed an opinion, you know, that they're not advocating for the end result at when they're starting this health impact assessment. So in other words, it's an objective study with independence of the lead agency.
Mm-hmm.
So after the scoping, which establishes a timeline and the sources of data that you're going to be using, you develop a work plan, and again, with the stakeholder input.
We're going through a little bit deeply into the whole process.
Yes.
And I think that may be a little too detailed
okay.
for our listeners.
Okay.
Can we just kind of say... So let me just see if I can summarize, and if I don't get it quite accurately, maybe you can help me. But, you know, basically what's happening is a health impact assessment is a way of identifying the potential health risk to diverse populations in diverse locales from the range of activities that would come into play. That would include both drilling at the well site as well as other parts of the process. So it's to address the full range of health risk and increase, or, you know, presumably it's not going to be decreased, but, you know, what is the range of health risks that could be generated? How would they affect certain identified groups of people? And how high a level of risk is there potentially to moving ahead with the process? And where are the most, I suppose also there could be a look at, you know, where the most intensive, moderate, and lower level of impacts would be. Is that kind of just an overview?
Yeah, that's a good
okay.
overview. The mm-hmm. purpose of a health impact assessment, and I think that's mm-hmm. probably the most important part of this,
mm-hmm.
is that it's to minimize and eliminate negative health impacts
mm-hmm.
and to maximize any potential positive health impacts. So
mm-hmm.
so you do look at all the potential health impacts, plus and minus, and you put them on a scale, and you determine whether it's going to be a positive impact, negative impact, to what degree, and on which populations, as you said.
Okay, that's good.
You do all of that in as a summary. That's how
good.
It's presented.
Okay, well, this is probably a good moment. We need to break for station identification. So thank you for that. I think we kind of co-created that a little bit there. So we'll be talking more about, now we've kind of laid the groundwork in terms of the health concerns, the health assessment, the health impact assessment. So on the second half of our show, I hope listeners will stay tuned, because we'll be talking about what's actually going to be going forward in New York State around this issue. So stay with us on Connect the Dots for the second half hour.
Well, well, well.
Welcome back, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Roslevy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Today, we're talking about the health impacts of fracking with Dr. Larissa Durska, and we're also talking about the role of a health impact assessment in really allowing scientists, doctors, policymakers, and citizens to look in advance at what the impact and health risks of a certain complex technology can be. In our society, we kind of understudy first. We don't always study first, and then we deal with the health impact later. And where you have something that's an industrial process, like fracking, which we're talking about today, that uses a lot of industrial hazardous chemicals and introduces them into the water, air, and food supply, taking a closer look in advance on what the health risks of this process could be is so important. That's why, to summarize from the first half of the show, many New Yorkers are happy that Governor Cuomo has paused in his process that he had initiated to move forward with fracking and is instead doing a health impact assessment. There was some disappointment in this announcement, although there was a sort of a good side and a bad side. The good side is that the Department of Environmental Conservation at the state level here in New York, the head of that, Peter Martin, said, if there are serious health problems, we will not proceed. In other words, if this newly announced health impact assessment being conducted in New York State reveals serious health problems, then they will not proceed with fracking. On the other hand, who is going to do the health study? And the Cuomo administration announced that it would be done internally by state bureaucrats rather than by independent scientific researchers. And given a whole range of factors that we'll discuss a little bit in this next segment, a lot of people have serious concerns about the quality of the assessment. So we're going to return to our guest, Dr. Larissa Durska, and discuss that issue. Larissa, why are people concerned about the integrity of a state-run health impact assessment?
Well, as you may know, in previous comments from both the Department of Environmental Conservation and the Department of Health, they have maintained that health impacts have been adequately addressed. So this is on the previous versions of the SGEIS. They've made comments that the health impacts have been adequately addressed. We've taken all precautions to make sure there won't be health impacts. We know that's not the case. We know that there are health impacts that, and 67,000 comments indicated that the SGEIS was not adequate in addressing health impacts in the range that we have identified them.
And did they speak about health impacts at all in these guidelines?
Did they have
any real science?
They spoke about air contamination and how they were going to prevent any health impacts because they're adhering to the federal guidelines and even more stringently than the federal guidelines. But they aren't taking into account the cumulative impacts of the different facilities, the different wells, the compressor stations, the processing plants. Because they don't have to. The federal government doesn't mandate that they be looked at cumulatively at this point. So nobody is. But the impacts are definitely there. And so they're not, they don't have a proposal to study these impacts because they say they're not going to be there. Well, that doesn't.
So that becomes a chicken egg thing.
Exactly.
So you say and then you don't study it, and then you don't know because you haven't studied it because you said it. What gives them the idea that there are no impacts? Is this an industry line that they have, a line from the gas industry that they've simply adopted, and taken, trusted them to do the right science and just assumed that it must be correct? Is that what's happening?
A lot, that, yeah, there was a lot of input from industry into the SGIS, and you know, that's an issue, a separate issue that Environmental Working Group and others have opened up, you know, to determine the influence of industry in writing the SGIS, but that is a separate issue. The medical profession was not at the table in preparing the SGIS. It's only our comments that have apparently now been heard, and the letters that we've written in the past to the governor and to Dr. Shaw, the commissioner of health, that have pointed out some of these impacts. So our voices have finally been heard, but the comments are all about the lack of transparency, the lack of health impacts included in the previous iterations of the SGIS. What our understanding is right now about the process that's going to be used and what we're concerned about is that this health impact analysis, it's not a true health impact assessment the way we understand it, the way we've defined it, the way the World Health Organization and the CDC and the National Academies of Sciences have identified and described it. This is a some sort of amorphous, undescribed as yet health analysis. We don't know what it looks like. We don't know if it's going to be a chapter that includes any mention of health within the SGIS and is now going to be put into one chapter. Or if
you're saying they may extract from the existing, let's just call them the guidelines, because I think these letters are so confusing for people. So you're saying they may just simply thumb through the guidelines, and if they mention health, they'll just take out that page, Xerox it, and that'll be the assessment. So it could be anything from that, and you're saying that what's in the guidelines is not adequate. So right now,
I just wanted to say that there are 67,000 comments that were made after that 2011 SGI, that guideline was published and came out for comments. So my thinking is that they included some of that. But we don't know to what extent they did that. So there's a lack of transparency that, and we're asking for that transparency. So we're asking for this this analysis, health impact analysis that's been prepared to be shared with the public, so that we can see what they're all talking about. So the other concern is that this health impact analysis that was prepared by the Department of Environmental Conservation, which is really not a public health agency, as you know, is going to be, this health impact analysis is going to be reviewed by the Department of Health, which has apparently, according to people that we've spoken to, been advising the DEC on their SGI, on their guidelines from the very beginning. So this becomes
a circular kind of thing from what you're describing.
Right,
in other
right.
words, they've already been advising them, and there already is incomplete information.
Right.
So how is there that person, that entity, the Department of Health of New York State, taking the lead when they've already been participating? How is that going to surface the scientific information that is incomplete right now that would be needed for
right.
a complete assessment? I think just to kind of make it a little clearer, you know, we'd mentioned earlier that there was a lack of transparency in how these guidelines overall were arrived at, and in fact, listeners may be interested to know what you referred to, the fact that the Environmental Working Group actually has sued to get complete information about how this came about, because there have been multiple instances of private conversations with industry, and even evidence that industry itself had a big role in shaping the guidelines. So this is, although this is that particular process is not 100% about health, that's the background for concerns and the need for having a transparent process so that the public and healthcare professionals can follow along at every step of the way and make sure that science is really undertaken and bona fide science is undertaken, because otherwise, you know, private decisions or promises made by interested parties that are not occurring in full public view could be, the risk is they could be tainting the process, and at the end of the day, there's a so-called health impact assessment, but it's not really a complete balanced, high-quality assessment. It could be very incomplete where certain things, information has come from. It could not be known to the public. And so that's why, that's the background for the call, you know, for transparency here. Let me just parenthetically just take a moment, too, to just speak to anyone who might be listening to this show now or in archives, where it will be as soon as we've finished the program, very shortly thereafter. And if you like the show, I ask people to please let other people know, especially let healthcare professionals know. Send them the link. And I want to speak to any who are hearing this show now, live or in archive. Basically, there have been a couple of instances where doctors and other healthcare professionals have signed letters and spoken out and made their joint voices and concerns known to Governor Cuomo in the past. And there may be, as this evolves, future opportunity for those who know health best to really let it be known that by the people who have to treat these problems how important this is. So I want to invite anyone who is listening, or anyone who knows someone who might be a healthcare professional, and I'll let Dr. Durska in a minute just kind of detail the sort of kinds of people we're looking for here. If you would like to participate, I'm inviting people to go to the website, because there is no kind of online place right away, so we're going to kind of borrow my website, healthjournalist.com, and you can go to Health Journalist blog or healthjournalist.com, and there's a sign-up box, and if you sign up there, there's a place where you can mark if you're a healthcare professional. So after you fill in your name and your email, you can mark if you're a healthcare professional or just, you know, a regular member of the public. Both are welcome. But especially if you're any kind of healthcare professional, and Larissa will detail, you know, what that constitutes, please do go and sign up and note that. And that way, if there are further activities where, you know, you could participate and weigh in as a healthcare professional, we can let you know. People can let you know. Larissa will be involved and let you know about that. So what kinds of people, you know, is this an invitation to?
Doctors, Larissa? Nurses, mm-hmm. public health professionals. So mm-hmm. Anyone who's involved in the delivery of healthcare or in the research part of healthcare. So, mm-hmm. you know, if you're doing public health research, we'd love to hear from you. By hearing from you, or when you submit your name, we'll keep you in the loop. You know, there will possibly be, and we're asking for additional hearings, so we would keep you informed about the timing of these hearings. We would let you know what the issues are. Sometimes we have letters, as Allison mentioned, that we send to the governor or to the commissioner, one of the commissioners. And these letters are about the process, you know, asking that the transparency of the process be followed, that that the process be objective, that it's trustworthy. You know, any process that is put out by the government should be trustworthy, and we're advocating for steps to be taken that it so that it has public trust.
That's very important. So
yes.
This is a way, you know, of course, we'll continue reporting on this, and as things evolve, you know, we'll update people through this program as well. But for people who are in the field, you know, everyone's voices are important, and on Connect the Dots, I've, you know, connected listeners to a whole range of different activist organizations and groups, you know, that can participate for all of us, we who are the general public. But this is also a very special time for healthcare professionals to step forward, make their voices heard, as well as, you know, be part of the eyes and ears to assure what Larissa's speaking of, which is a complete, transparent, and trustworthy process. And,
right, and we're advocates for public health, you know, whether we're pediatricians advocating on behalf of our children, the children who don't have a voice, they don't have a vote, some of them can't even speak. So, you know, we have to be their advocates, and the medical profession has taken that seriously. You know, the other subspecialties advocate on behalf of their populations, and we mm-hmm. advocate on behalf of the communities that we serve. So, mm-hmm. you know, we're in a the medical profession is in a unique position here to mm-hmm. to as public servants mm-hmm. to advocate for the people that we serve.
You know, that's a beautiful thing because, you know, we your articulation of what it means to be a health professional really goes right back to the deepest roots of healthcare. You know, in the initial impulse, and of course, you know, in this time with you know, millions and billions of dollars spent on pharmaceutical drugs and all the rest of it, kind of lost sight of that original calling to be a physician, which you and to serve through being a physician, which you articulate so beautifully, Larissa. Let me ask you something. I know that you know, we've talked about a lot of the sort of complexity of public policy as it intersects with science. You know, this is not as easy as take some vitamin C and eat an apple a day, you know, in terms of a health show. But let me ask you, what is your commitment as a pediatrician? Is there an experience that you could share or some way that you moved in your own journey to serve children in this broader sense? I would love to hear that if there is something, you know, that you could share with us. I know it's a tough question.
It is. It is very tough. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we all choose routes that are, you know, that we find the most rewarding. I recall as a child, I never had a pediatrician per se. I had a family practitioner taking care of me and my whole family. Mm-hmm. But I was a Girl Scout. There were people who were important who were taking care of children. And I thought, I want to be one of those people who takes care of children. And, mm-hmm. you know, I was also interested in the sciences. So it just all came together that you know, someone who wanted to be a doctor, to become a physician, that I would choose pediatrics simply because I really like that population, and I've had good experiences of people advocating for me and being a spokesperson for me. I remembered that as a child, and I wanted to do something similar. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a, you know, some one decision or one moment that created this thought. It was a combination, and I think that's probably the case for everybody, you know, that goes into a particular specialty. You know, you like the science and you see what your skill set is. I've always enjoyed the interaction with children who can't actually speak for themselves.
So in this
be able
fracking,
to understand them.
In this fracking issue, it is true, is it not, that children are at greater risk?
Yes.
Can you just kind of give our listeners a little bit of a picture of that?
Sure.
Why?
Children,
and then, just for a few minutes, because we're going to come down to the end of the show pretty soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And thank you for asking about how children are impacted, because that's very important. Their metabolism is different. They breathe faster. they're closer to the ground, they pick up things from the ground. So, you know, that in the ingestion of things that may be contaminated, they're breathing air that's closer to the ground. That's where the heavy metals and the ozone and volatile organic compounds, the ground level ozone, I mean, congregate. And so, and they, because they breathe faster, they are bringing all of this material into their lungs faster and metabolizing it, and their metabolism is faster. They also eat more and drink more per body weight in comparison to adults. So children are going to be taking in more of these toxins, and their metabolism may not be able to take care of it as quickly as they take it in. Also, they have a much longer lifetime than, you know, somebody who's 50 years old already. And so these toxins or other chemicals that accumulate in their bodies are going to be doing their work or their damage or whatever for a much longer time. And so, you know, there's a greater chance of toxic effects appearing long-term. Endocrine disruptors have a more significant effect, different effect on children, just as they do on the fetus, because it's developing, and so, you know, certain organ systems can be impacted if it's if that organ system is exposed during its development to a particular chemical or endocrine disruptor. So those are just some of the dangers. And then finally, children just, you know, as I mentioned before, just cannot speak for themselves. Well, thank you, listeners. We've just had a little bit of a technical problem, but I just want to thank Dr. Larissa Derschke for cluing us in on the health impacts and the coming health impact assessment and the need to keep that a transparent process. So we're just at the beginning of that, and it really could be a game changer. Again, I want to encourage any listeners, you're all invited to come to my website, healthjournalist.com, healthjournalistblog.com, and sign up. And if you are a health professional or know people who are, please invite them to indicate that they are, in order to be part of the group that keeps eyes on this health assessment and make sure it really works for the public. Thank you so much for listening today. To Connect the Dots, I'm with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. We are having some very interesting shows coming up in upcoming weeks. And the show is also available in archives. So if you've enjoyed this show, or please pass it along to others. And if you want to listen and bone up on some other aspects of health and fracking, please do listen and rate us on iTunes if you've enjoyed the program. So tune in next week to Connect the Dots, and I'll be with you then. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Thanks. Well, 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 well.